This crown's my task.
Be seated, please. We have all been made sober and have been saddened by the report regarding our brother, Robert Street. That's, of course, selfishness on our part, but we recognize that and God recognizes it. I saw him last night for a good long while, and he asked me if I would please to make a statement for him, which I want to do at this time. He had been doing some introspection, as you always do under circumstances like that. And he says, I find that there's nothing in my life for which I would need to make any confession of wrongs. But he said, in everyone's life, there probably are occasions of misunderstandings with people. And he said, there probably are those in the congregation here who have misunderstood good intentions of his. And he says that he wants to make whatever effort is necessary to right those misunderstandings. He says that he genuinely cares for each one of you in this congregation, and that his only desire is to be with each one of you in heaven. He said, please underline this statement and emphasize it. He says, I am not afraid. I am not afraid. But he says, I am selfish enough to want to live. But he says, I've had time to prepare, which some people have not been given. He says, I'm in the hands of the best doctors, Christian doctors, the best that could be had. And then he says, and then in addition to that, all of it is in the hands of God. And he says, I know whom I have believed, and I am persuaded that he is able to keep what I've committed to him against that day. And then he asked that I make one supreme effort to convince you of one thought that he has in mind, something that he was planning on speaking to the young people at the Young People's Workshop this coming January the 5th. He had intended to say to them, and perhaps he can yet, but he wanted to say it to you today. Don't waste your life being afraid to use what talent God has given you. He said he wasted some years of his life by regretting that God had not given him other talents, and he was afraid to use the talents that he had. But then he came to himself and began to use very effectively the talents that God has given him. I can truthfully say that he's one of the most shepherding of all of the elders that I've ever met. He's in good spirits. I had difficulty believing that he was even ill. And I have confidence in God that he'll use him however he pleases. And Brother Street says that's fine with me. He says, I'm happy. If I go on now and be with the Lord, I'm just as happy as I can be. He says, I'm not afraid, and I'm confident. So he asked me to make this statement for him today. I'm going to ask that over the next few days, as we're together in groups, in homes for various celebrations and parties, I'm going to ask that we especially remember on every occasion that we're together, and then in private, let's lift up this man's name before the throne of our Father and ask that his will be done, but ask specifically that he be spared if it be possible. After I walked out of the room, having prayed with him and having heard him express his hope for the future, having heard him say, I'm not afraid, as I walked out of the door, this song was playing over the loudspeaker system or the intercommunication system of the hospital. O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above the deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. And I thought how appropriate that song was, as in this man who is a follower of Jesus of Nazareth, the hopes and the fears that have always been characteristic of the lives of human beings as long as they've been on the earth, they met in triumph in the Lord Jesus Christ and were there in reality that very night. I want to tell you a story this morning and make some applications. I want to tell you a story about a young man who spent the last moments of his life hanging by his neck in a tree, and who hung there at the mercy of his enemies, who quickly surrounded him and drove their arrows and their darts and their swords into his heart. And they then took him down and threw him into a pit and raised up a huge mound of stones above him as a memorial to the folly of rebellion. And they'll have to go down as a memorial that says simply, here was a failure. The news of Absalom's death was brought to David, his father. And a distraught, sorrowing, sobbing father began to moan, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom. How I would that I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." I can't think of a passage in all the Bible that is more pitiful than that one scene. I can't think of a moaning cry that reaches down and touches the heart so as this distraught father and his cry over his wayward son touches our hearts today. This had to have been an account of a living example or a living incident. You don't create fiction with such a touch of reality and realism as this cry yields to us today. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, how I would that I had died for thee, O my son Absalom. As we look at this scene today, I want us to see in this portrait some qualities and some characteristics that served as contributing factors to this failure. We're faced today with a parental crisis. I do not believe that we're faced with a youth crisis. I believe that the thing that most shockingly presents itself to America as being the need of the day is parents to be parents. And as we look at it, I think we can detect a formula for failure. We can't say that there's any real simple definition or simple solution. The guilt lies, no doubt, on Absalom as well as on his father. The solutions aren't simple, and those who are guilty are more than just one. And young people, regardless of what kind of parents you may have, you're responsible before God. You may be responsible for not as much as your parents are, but nevertheless, you're responsible. What you are right now may be the result of what your parents made you. But what you are in the future depends upon what you make of yourself by the grace of God. And as we ask the question this morning, whose fault was this? It'll have to be understood that part of the blame lies upon Absalom. But it's not Absalom that I'm going to talk about today. I want us to look at his daddy. Look at David, a good man in so many ways, an outstanding man, a man after God's own heart. But he had faults that we cannot overlook and that God saw fit to not overlook either. And they are recorded here for our learning, that we might understand some of the things that were his failures that caused his son to become such a subject of shame as he became. What were the contributing factors? I'm going to mention just about two major ones and then maybe two minor ones. Number one, an improper marriage. God had warned Israel against marrying outside of the faith. And in 2 Samuel chapter 3, it simply says that David bore Absalom of the woman Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. This was a nation of people. The Geshurites lived on the northeastern bank of the Sea of Galilee. They occupied what we know now as the Golan Heights, that and northeast of there. They were a foreign nation of people. They were not Jewish people. And for some reason or other, and it's not only this woman, but David married other women who were of foreign extract. But this woman is the one we're concerned with now because she was Absalom's mother. There may be many reasons why God asked the Jews not to marry outside the Jewish faith. I think there are some national implications that for the national security, for the preservation of the nation of the Jews, I think he had them marry within their own people. This is brought out in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 3 through 6. He talks about how that this was a national issue. He said, "You are a holy people, and I have separated you to be a very special people to me. You are a people holy to the Lord, your God. The Lord, your God, has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples that are on the face of the earth. And therefore," he said, "you shall not make marriages with them, giving your daughters to their sons and taking their daughters for your sons. For they had turned away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly." So for the preservation of the nation, he had them marry among themselves. There were religious overtones also. In the book of Exodus, the first time this was mentioned, he forbade them to marry other people. He said, "Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they play the harlot after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and one invites you, you eat of his sacrifice, and you take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters play harlot after their gods, and make your sons play the harlot after their gods." So there were religious implications here too. He wanted to preserve the purity of their religion. Their national security and preservation was at stake. Their religious purity was at stake. And yet you can't destroy a nation without destroying its people. You can't undermine a nation without first undermining its people. And you can't make a religion become impure without first tampering with the people and destroying the integrity and the purity of the people. And that's why this prohibition that God gave that would limit a Jew from marrying anyone but a Jew had greater implications and much more severe overtones than just national security or religious purity. These things had to do with the mothers and the fathers of their children. And when you marry a boy or you marry a girl, you're not just marrying your husband or you're not just marrying your wife. When you marry a girl, you're marrying the mother of your children. When you marry a boy, you're marrying not just a husband, but you're marrying the father of your children. Most of us here today have already chosen our life's mate. Did you make a wise choice or not? Would you ask yourself that question in terms of your children? When you think of your children, those that you've already born, would you think for just a moment of your husband or of your wife? And would you come to a conclusion in your heart, I made a wise choice, or I made an unwise choice? Now, the reason why I'm asking that you do this is because your mate is going to know what you're thinking, because she knows you better than anybody on the face of this earth. She knows whether you're selfish. She knows whether you're not the kind of man that you ought to be. She knows whether you're a Christian. She knows whether or not, because of you, her job as a wife has been much more difficult. Or he knows whether, because of you, his job as a father has been so much more difficult. You see, he or she will know about the other as to whether or not the marriage that you contracted with her or with him 25 or 30 years ago was a mistake. What's the answer in your own life? This man made a mistake. I don't even know his wife. I know her name. No one knows any more about her than that. But I know her background, and she may have been fine in many respects, but she did not know the God that we know. She didn't know the God that David knew. She was a heathen. And regardless of what all she might have been able to contribute, the way in which David took this woman to be his wife was not an honorable way. He took her as the seal of a political agreement with another king. He took his daughter as a wife and went into her and begat this son, Absalom. And it was a mistake. His choice of a mother for Absalom was one of the biggest things about Absalom's future, I'm confident, that was on the negative side. But that was already done. Your mate has already been chosen. Whether it was a mistake or not, you'll have to live with it regardless. But there's a second thing that was a mistake on David's part. And that was that David himself provided an improper example. An improper example in the sense, and you know the occasion in his life to which I refer, the incident with Bathsheba was an incident in David's life that he never got over as long as he lived. God said to David, because you have utterly despised me, the sword will not pass from your house as long as you live. He committed adultery with this woman, the wife of another man. And then he murdered the man after trying unsuccessfully to cover it up and to be the hypocrite and provide the incident whereby the man would think that the child that she was carrying was his own child rather than David's child. And after having committed adultery, and after then having played the part of a hypocrite to the hilt, and after having manipulated people's lives, the man, his life, until David manipulated him, but he wouldn't be manipulated. And then after having failed in all of those points, this king then gave instructions to his leader of his army. See to it that he doesn't come home. Pull back from him and let him be killed in battle. And he manipulated this whole master scheme whereby he could cover up his hideous sin. I suspect that Absalom was a teenager when his father was doing this. Don't think that it was a hidden thing. Fathers, you don't hide from your children what you're doing. They know. We just don't hide from young people what's going on in the family. This young man perhaps heard it from a neighbor. Because you see, David asked about Bathsheba. He went and asked someone, who is that woman that lives in that house? And someone, it doesn't say who it was, but they told him, isn't that Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And then perhaps they saw the woman come into David's quarters. Then they perhaps heard or saw someone bring a message to David. And then they saw the notice of Uriah's death. And then they saw David take this woman into his own home as his wife. And they saw all of these things. And then you don't think that that would be limited to one person. That would spread just like wildfire. And then it would come back to the son, this teenage boy, Absalom, and he would know, my father is an adulterer. He didn't set the right example before his own boy. I wish I could tell you what that does to a young man. I wish I could tell you the incidents in my office where young people have broken down and cried out and said how they hated their father because of the fact that he had been an adulterer. Improper example. Not necessarily just in adultery, but are you the kind of father that sets the proper example for your son in any other way? Are you setting the proper example for them? Does he see you love your wife? Does he see you love and respect his mother? Or does he see you, a man, totally wrapped up in himself, who shows disrespect to his mother, if anything, and who is always and forever looking out only after his own interests? You're always gone in some activity or some sport, something that doesn't involve your wife, his mother, and doesn't involve the children, just you and your selfish self. Does he see that in you? It'll come home to you. Does he see you dishonest? Whatever it may be that's inconsistent in your life, you can count on it. It's going to come home to you. It came home to David. Absalom's defiance took the same shape that his father's rebellion against God took. Nathan came in to David and told him that, David, you're the man. You're the one that has stolen this sheep from this man that only had one. And you're the one that killed this sheep, and you satisfied your own appetites at the expense of another man. And when David was given this insight into himself, David said, I've sinned. But listen to what the penalty was. Oh, God forgave him. Nathan said, God has forgiven you of that, but not of the consequences. He said, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house, and I'll take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son, for you did it secretly. But I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. And sure enough, later on, when Absalom had taken over Jerusalem and David had fled, do you know what the advice of Ahithophel was? The advice of Ahithophel was, go into your father's concubines that he had left there over the house. He had left 10 concubines to take care of his residence in Jerusalem. Go to your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself odious to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom upon the roof, and Absalom went in to his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Today we're seeing that same thing repeated all over this country. What your generation and mine and the ones maybe before us, what our generation did in secret, living inconsistently with the God who made them, what we have done in secret is not being done in secret by those who have come after us. They've seen the inconsistency in the lives of our generation, and this generation just lets it all hang out. They don't care. They are going into a tent on the roof of the houses and commit their whoredoms openly. But David set the pace. And this incident of how Absalom paid back his daddy, and you'd be surprised how many times this comes to be the motive for the sins of many a young man. He does it to pay back his daddy because of the inconsistency of the example that was set before him by his own father. There are many other things that could be said. I'll mention one other thing, but really these two are the most important factors in this young man's failure: an improper marriage and then an inadequate example on the part of his own father. Because the third thing that I want to mention is simply inadequate discipline. David didn't have what it took to discipline his own son. And you know why? Because whenever you compromise your position by living that's not in line with your profession, and it's inconsistent with you what you know to be right and what your sons know to be right, when you've compromised your position on that point, then you have no position from which to make any real serious effort of discipline. This comes out whenever Amnon, David's half-brother, he raped Tamar. And Absalom kept it quiet and said, "Don't tell anyone, Tamar, I'll take care of it." 2 years went by and he murdered this man, Amnon. But the thing was set up by Absalom so that his father would give his blessing to his father and all of his brothers going on a sheep-shearing expedition with him. And he kept pressing his father, wanting him to go, and he didn't take no for an answer. He just kept pressing him. His father didn't go himself, but he let his sons go, all of them. But it says twice that he kept pressing him, which indicated that here was a man who had a son, and the son would not take no for an answer. He kept insisting and kept pressing and kept nagging until finally the father compromised and let something be done that he really didn't think was right or best. And then it came later also, after he had killed his brother Amnon, he fled to his granddaddy and his grandmother over in Geshur, the mother and father of his own mother. He left his own home, his father David, and that family setting, and went up into Geshur, and there he stayed with his grandparents on his mother's side. They were heathen people. They didn't have the same respect for right as David's family had. But he went up there, and there he stayed for 3 years. And then finally, Joab manipulated David and brought him into a position of where he was in a compromising position, and he couldn't do otherwise. And so he said, "All right, bring the boy on back home." And so after 3 years of being up in Geshur with his grandparents on his mother's side, David allowed this boy to come back to Jerusalem. But the strange thing about it, and yet it's not strange either, David would not face the boy. He would not let the boy come into his presence. He put him in an apartment of his own, a house of his own, and he said, I don't want to see him." And look what you've got here. You have an inaccessible father. You have an offended son. You have a father who was an improper example, an offended son, then in turn an inaccessible father. And then watch what happened next. This boy, after about 2 years of not being able to see his father, and he had sent a message to Joab repeatedly, "Get me an audience with my father. I want to see him." But Joab wouldn't do it. And then finally, the boy resorts to violence. He burned a field of wheat of Joab. Burned the whole field. And Joab came and said, "Why did you burn my field?" And he did what the world today is doing, committing acts of violence and oppression in order to draw attention to a cause. And finally, then David admitted the boy into his presence, but he wasn't in any position to discipline him. All it says he did was he kissed him, and that's all that it says. After an absence of 5 years, not one word did David say to his own son that we have any record of. It just says he kissed him. No discipline on the part of the father. You know why? How do you know that? You know it because there was no communication. Communication is the basis of discipline. And any parent who finds himself or herself in such a position that you cannot and will not communicate with your children, you're not exercising the proper discipline with them. And how many of us fathers turn this kind of communication and this kind of discipline over to our wives? How many of us find ourselves willing to lie in the bed and say, "They're your children, you take care of them"? You're going to reap it one day if that's the case. You're going to reap what you've sown to the wind. You're going to reap the whirlwind one day. I could give you some previews of what's going to be happening, because I could reproduce in your mind the scenes that have taken place in my office of children who have come whose fathers never did really have much to do with them at all, and who were raised totally by their mothers. And boys who come in resentment and bitterness because they never could get to their father. The fathers were inaccessible. And knowing and having the children ask them, and then have them be sent off to be cared for by the mothers and be advised by the mothers, but don't bother me. I'm going hunting, or I'm going fishing, or I'm going to do something else, but don't bother me. You wait. And I would like to prevent this from happening. David made an inadvisable marriage. He provided an improper example, and he gave inadequate discipline. David was a failure. You know who it showed up in, though? David was forgiven. But Absalom lies under a pile of rocks right now, because the mother and the father were not what they should have been. What about you? Did you make an inadvisable contract with a husband or wife? Are you an improper example? Have you given inadequate discipline? Listen to what Jesus says. He says it's better for a man to have a millstone hanged around his neck and to be thrown into the depths of the sea than to cause one of these little ones to stumble. Now, the reason why I've chosen to speak on this subject today is because the men of this congregation are being invited by the shepherds of this congregation to an encampment that will be speaking specifically to this problem. Not every one of you will come to the encampment. Some of you will be perhaps too old, and you say, well, it doesn't pertain to me. But there are at least 125 men in this congregation to whom it does apply. Would you like to prevent a disaster happening to your own children? You can help. There are two pads and pencils here, and we're asking that you seriously consider what kind of an example you're setting before your boys and girls. I ask you, and I advise you, please, would you give just simply, it's not even a full day. It starts at 6:30 on Friday night and is over by 12 o'clock the next day. That's about 16 hours. Would you give 16 hours to come and let the elders of this congregation advise you as part of their flock? Would you take the time off from whatever activities you have scheduled and planned? Would you do that? There are going to be medical doctors on panels answering questions that you might ask them concerning case histories that they could advise you about. There are going to be elders talking to you. There'll be a very experienced man, Prentice Metter from Springfield, Missouri, who will be coming to speak on the subject of family life and family enrichment. He's been preaching and studying on it for a solid year. He's geared. He's ready to go. He'll give you all of this benefit of his learning. There are going to be other things. There'll be books perhaps on display. There'll be time for you to ask questions. All of this is available, provided you're interested enough in your children to come. This doesn't mean that everybody that doesn't come isn't interested in their children. But let me tell you, if you have children and they're in the age when they're moldable and you refuse to take advantage of this opportunity, I think I would really look seriously at myself to see the motive for it. But the opportunity is yours. We're going to have a great time. These pads are here for you to sign. I hope that 125, that's about how many we can accommodate. I hope you'll come, and let's all go out there together and see if we can't avoid the mistakes that David made. I know you don't want your own son to be the cause for your saying, oh, Peter, oh, whatever your son's name may be, how I would to God that I had died for you. Well, here's an opportunity for you to commit yourself in about 18 hours to him, and it may change the entire direction of his life and yours. We hope that you will consider it seriously. Consider your role as fathers and mothers, and may we be encouraged, and may we stand now and encourage one another with this hymn.